Welcome to this episode of Real World HR, the podcast that puts the human back into HR. Today I have a very special guest, Dr. Jennifer Cotton, a renowned clinical psychologist and co-founder of TalkWorks. Jennifer is not just a clinical expert, but also a passionate advocate for making mental health services accessible to everyone. In 2014, she co-founded TalkWorks, which provides rapid access to mental health support for those who need it. With a rich background in psychology, Jennifer holds a doctorate in clinical psychology and a postgraduate and diploma in cognitive behavioural therapy, CBT. CBT, as you know, is a transformational talk and therapy that helps individuals identify and change patterns in their thoughts, feelings and behaviours. But that's not all. Jennifer recently added another feather to her cap by qualifying in EMDR, a groundbreaking therapy particularly effective for those who have experienced trauma. In today's episode, we'll explore the ins and outs of these therapies, delve into Jennifer's journey in psychology, and discuss how TalkWorks is revolutionary in mental health support. So whether you're an employer looking to support your employees, a podcast enthusiast, or someone serious about understanding neurodiversity, this episode is definitely for you. Are you ready to step into the real world of HR? So thank you so much for coming along to do this podcast today, Jen. And I'm just really excited about having the conversation around this comes up time and time and time again, as you can imagine, from a HR point of view. So if you just want to kind of start off with who you are, I've given a little bit of background, but who you are, what you do, and kind of, I suppose, in essence, what's your drivers to kind of make you be as enthused around what it is that you do?
Thank you for having me here today, Louise. I really appreciate it. So, yeah, I'm Jen. I'm a clinical psychologist and co-founder of TalkWorks. So we're a mental health support business. We've been going for about 10 years. I co-founded it with Jane McCarthy, another consultant clinical psychologist in the Northeast. And we help people, particularly employees, to recover from episodes of mental ill health by delivering quality talk and therapy fast. We cover a range of mental health conditions, from anxiety to trauma, OCD, managing difficult life events. We also deliver clinician-led training for employees in mental health.
Right, okay.
Covering things like sleep, resilience, and of course, neurodiversity.
Yeah.
And what drives me is, as you said in that kind introduction, just wanting to make therapy accessible for all.
For all people.
Yeah, for all people, no matter what your background, where you work in. At TalkWorks, we want to help people to recover quickly from an episode of mental health.
From mental health. So obviously you trained as being a psychologist initially. What was your kind of experience from, I'm assuming you got a job, when you were kind of just trained as being a psychologist. So what happened between training as a psychologist and you starting TalkWorks? What happened in that time that made you think, actually, I want to go out there and start a business that can help and support people?
So I worked in the NHS for many years, and my most recent job in the NHS, I was a specialist deaf practitioner, so I'm a British Sign Language user as well.
Yeah.
So I'm trained up to level 6 in BSL, and I was working in a service that spanned across the country, actually, working with deaf children and their families.
Right.
And then I had my own family, mm-hmm. and the NHS wasn't quite as flexible an employer as I would have liked.
Yeah.
So I left the NHS to prioritise my own family and work flexibly, mm-hmm. worked a little bit in private practice, and then increasingly was experiencing local employers coming along saying, listen, we've got this really valued member of staff that's unwell and we'd like them to have some support quickly to keep them in their job,
yeah.
and because it's the right thing to do. And so Jane and I identified that as a need and in the Northeast, and we've been working together ever since.
Ever since. So
yeah.
I suppose kind of backtracking a little bit, so I've worked in HR for about 25 years or so. Sounds like a long time when you say that, doesn't it? but for about 25 years or so, and obviously you set the business up in 2014. I don't think mental health was such a big topic back in 2014, was it? I certainly wasn't. I think for us it's been kind of maybe sort of the last 5-6 years is when it's when the businesses are talking about when businesses are needing to support their employees. I think it's been about that time frame. But obviously you kind of started before that. Was it just a little bit of a start of the rise in demand? As you said, people were coming to you and asking for some support.
Absolutely. So local employers were asking for support, but wanting it quicker than they were able to get it, perhaps through insurance companies or through the NHS. So we were able to meet that need demand, then. And there was a demand, you know, even in 2014. Mm-hmm. Yes, there might have been less of a demand than there is today, but there certainly was still a demand there.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So have you just kind of seen like a steady increase over time, or have you seen any kind of significant increases that have gone up? I'm kind of pointing my hand at
I think the trends that we've seen is increasingly, and especially since COVID, and I know lots of people don't tend to talk about COVID, but I think it's a pivotal point, isn't it?
we're still
seeing the ripples today.
Definitely.
From you know, from the trauma that's occurred over the last 4 years, COVID related, almost 4 years. I think what we've seen since COVID is an increasing amount of trauma surfacing in terms of the workplace, that people are then going to their employers saying, I'm struggling, but it's not necessarily work-related. It might be actually the pandemic has brought about loss, and that's reminded them of previous losses, or the demands placed upon the NHS mean, unfortunately, that you have to be, you know, either particularly persistent or increasingly severe to be able to have early access to mental health support through that route.
And I think that is an element of, without, you know, obviously the NHS do great work, and but that
fantastic
is one,
work,
of,
yeah.
one of the disappointing things, isn't it, that there are, but I suppose there's so many people out there that need to access the services, and actually the demand's higher than what they can deliver on. And I think it's so difficult for, you know, it's great when the company can support people and help them to be able to kind of pay for that service, or people pay out their pockets and pay for it themselves, because the need is there, and actually some people can't move on without that support element of it that goes with kind of counselling service and psychology services from there as well, isn't it?
Absolutely. And so the employees that we work with, you know, they are funding rapid access to mental health support for their employees, which works well.
And it works well. Mm-hmm. And do you kind of say, I mean, from our point of view, when we kind of, so we'll work with employers and we work with many different clients, and, you know, someone will come along and say, actually, somebody's suffering, you know, whatever it may be. They might be off sick, or they might be, you know, kind of present at work, but however, not really managing particularly well on a day-to-day basis. And it's great when a company kind of wants to invest in their employees and do it in that type of way, because I just think it shows kind of the quality of the employer in the first place. But actually, I also think that you get a huge amount of loyalty back from the employee. You know, we see people that actually, when they've had that support from a company paying for them to have some, you know, counselling support or whatever the service may be under that, that actually they stay with the company, they are loyal to them. They
absolutely
recognise that fact, don't they?
We do see that. We see, you know, people very grateful to their employers for the opportunity to engage in some rapid access counselling and psychological therapy. Yeah, and just really feeling valued by their employer. It makes a difference.
Yeah, I think it does. I think we see that quite a big difference. And do you feel like kind of that getting people back into the workplace quicker? Do you believe that it does get people back into the workplace quicker? It's probably as,
absolutely. Absolutely. And that the research would support that, as would, I guess, at the data that we have internally too, that, you know, early intervention matters.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We know that people on average wait at least 11 months before telling anybody in a medical profession, so their GP or going to an NHS service, that they're struggling with their mental
11
health.
11 months.
11 months on average, and that's for your initial presentation to say, actually, I'm not well here. I'm struggling with sleep or anxiety or a low mood. And then at that point, if you're then having to wait longer to access services, you can very quickly deteriorate.
Yeah.
So the employers that we work with, they tend to be employers that have, you know, great line management training, that good leadership, that their values are around doing the right thing, that there's policies there to support people quickly.
And I think they're all really important points that you said there. I think kind of from that, understanding the values of the business, you know, we've talked about that quite a lot when we've done our podcast around kind of understanding what the culture of the business is, understand the values of the business and how they want to be able to enable the support to the employees that are in the business, because it inevitably, you know, it makes a difference of how they're going to be treated. But it makes the employee feel comfortable to step up to say, actually, I'm not doing great here, I do need some help or I need some support. And I know not every business can afford to do it, but those that can and want to, then I think it does make a substantial difference to them. So I think that's really important. But I think also having strong managers who would recognise that actually, oh, Jen's not doing that well at the moment, and I'm not quite sure, you know, kind of knowing the people mm-hmm. that are in your team to kind of enable that pickup, that's invaluable as
absolutely.
Well.
Absolutely. So if you've got managers who are confident enough to approach people, if they've got the language to be able to say, listen, I noticed that you've been late a couple of times over the last few weeks, that's not like you.
Yeah.
Is there anything going on at home that you'd like to talk about?
Mm-hmm.
Or people who not just noticing and able to have the conversation, but also are approachable themselves and are able to contain any disclosure and handle that appropriately. Because that can be quite, you know, scary for some people if somebody discloses to you the extent of their mental health problems. As you say, it takes a confident manager
to be able to handle that. It's quite, I've been doing an in-depth investigation this week, and one of the things that's been coming from one of the employees that's involved in it, he just keeps saying the business haven't supported enough. But when you know, from that HR professional point of view, you think, well, actually they have. Mm-hmm. You know, you've been off, you've come back to work, you've done a first return, they've offered you counselling services, offered you like a boot service, they've offered this. But actually, it's then understanding what his offering or what he wanted as that offering.
Absolutely,
so kind of
what
actually,
his expectation there.
And his expectation in that situation was he wanted somebody in-house, like his manager, to be able to sit and listen to him and provide him some advice. Mm-hmm. Now, that's a bit of a manager, this is kind of a warehouse type facility. The guy that's the manager, I wouldn't imagine, is trained, or I don't even know whether you've got to be, you know, a certain type of person that can take on board other people's concerns, listen to them, and then provide them some advice. And I just thought, oh, that's quite interesting that the employees, that's what he's thought that he's want, or that's what he wants in the workplace. But actually, that's not always what a company can deliver on, is it? Because that's like, I was talking to someone about it, and I said, does Zoe want a kind of like an in-house counselling service? Like, you could have counsel with, you know, his manager, where actually the manager was like a warehouse manager, and he didn't, that wasn't part of his skill set, and nothing wrong with him, you know, from the way he was delivering himself, but it wasn't part of his skill set to be able to do that. So it's interesting, it's about asking the employee what it is that they want from the support.
What they want from the support. And actually, in that instance, although the employee's saying he's wanting advice from his line manager, and you're right that it's not the line manager's job to give mental health advice and to give counselling. But perhaps there's another layer to it, which is about a compassionate communication and the line manager being able to have time for him and listen in an empathic way.
Yeah.
So when we do our mental health awareness training for line managers, we do, you know, we'll showcase some of our team doing some role plays of those conversations where they go right and where they go wrong. And giving the audience that opportunity to be able to flag up, okay, what would you do differently next time?
Yeah. But I think that's really important, you know, situations to be in, isn't it? I know Deb from our team, she's come along and done the mental health training with you guys, and she said she really enjoyed the fact that, because you can't have a trainer, but then you have a psychologist in the room as well, isn't it? And she said that was such a good mix, because then, you know, if people did want to share things but had a little bit more difficult questions, then all the questions could be answered while you're kind of at that point.
Absolutely.
So it's kind of a good makeup element of it there as well. So I think that's really interesting. So I just want to talk to you around neurodiversity. Mm-hmm. So neurodiversity, you know, we've talked about mental health as far as when this started, those peaks. Neurodiversity is really a word that's probably come on my radar. Maybe it's just over the last couple of years, you know, it's kind of just started tinkering around a couple of years ago. We first started hearing a couple of people mention it, and then you're kind of people making reference with children, and then starting to think about how it, from an adult base point of view. Do you want to kind of, I suppose, that's a starting point, explain what neurodiversity is?
What is it?
What is it?
What is neurodiversity?
The word's been used, isn't it? And it's been used in the workplace, and the managers, the companies don't necessarily know what it is and what to do. So a good starting point is what is it?
What is it?
Yes.
So, put simply, neurodiversity is the range of different ways of learning, thinking and processing information. It's an umbrella term encompassing a range of identified conditions, including ADHD, autism, dyslexia, dyspraxia, Tourette's, among others.
Yeah.
So we have this umbrella term, and you're right, we're increasingly talking about it in the workplace over the last 1 or 2 years. But it affects so many of us. 1 in 7 of us is neurodiverse.
Right. But it is a new term. It's not that people have been missing out on the term. It is a new term that's come through, isn't it?
Yeah. I think, I mean, I'm trying to think when we first came across the term, I think it was about the late 1990s maybe, there was a sociologist came up with the term neurodivergence, which has then since been used to describe, you know, different ways that the brain might work. Because we don't all think and behave the same way.
And I think that's a difficulty, isn't it? Because people just expect people to turn up, you know, they expect people to turn up for work and to behave in the same way as everybody else behaves, isn't it? And I think then when you start talking about the term neurodiversity, and I think we've seen, certainly for me, kind of over the last year, seen the number of adults that are being tested for all of the range of different areas that you just mentioned there. Mm-hmm. That has been such a significant rise for adults being tested, hasn't it?
It's skyrocketed. Yeah.
And is that, because obviously I think from the last I heard, the NHS has taken about 2 or 3 years to go through the testing. But then people are paying privately for that as well, aren't they?
They are, yeah, they are paying privately to do that too. I mean, there are other options as well. So the NHS has the right to choose option, which means that you don't have to be seen locally. Mm-hmm. So you can access various national services to assess autism and ADHD, particularly over a video facility.
All right, okay. Mm-hmm.
Which that does cut the waiting list in some areas, but still it's 6-12 months.
Yeah, so it's still significant.
It's still a long
time.
Yeah.
Why do you think there's a rise of people going to get tested?
I think it's twofold. So we're seeing people as adults, their children are now being identified as experiencing ADHD or autism and other neurodiversities. And that's being picked up in school because education places are much more well-trained now.
Yeah,
and they're much more aware than they were. Mm-hmm. And then when your child has been diagnosed with something that you haven't necessarily noticed it as a problem because it's been normal for your family, you then start to question, oh, actually, have I got an ADHD? Or might I be sitting somewhere on this spectrum too? Mm-hmm. So I think the awareness raising around children with neurodiversity has then impacted on parents.
Right, okay.
I also think that, I'm going to pull back to the pandemic again, I think COVID's had an impact, and the reason for that is that many of us have begun to work in different ways, forced by COVID. Mm-hmm. And so suddenly we're starting to experience things like, oh my goodness, I work much better at home when it's really quiet.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Or actually, I'm not as productive when there's not 25 people around me.
Yeah.
Or I prefer information presented to me live versus on paper. And we're starting to get that, or people are starting to get that insight into how we work best and how we thrive, and then that naturally taps into neurodiversity in different conditions, which would map onto that.
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting point you made then, which I hadn't thought of around COVID being that point, because obviously everybody all of a sudden was working from home, and some people could manage that and some people couldn't, could they? You know, some people just didn't want to be alone. Obviously, I know there was the loneliness element of it, but they didn't want to be alone in those situations. But I think it gives people the opportunity to think about how they receive information, who they're with, and the circumstances around it as well.
Absolutely. Mm. And if you discover that actually you've been spending an hour on the metro getting to work every morning and arriving frazzled because you're overstimulated because of neurodiversity, why would you not then want to change things?
To change what it is that you're doing. Yeah. And it's so difficult, I'm probably going to flit around here a little bit, but it's so difficult from an employer point of view, isn't it? Because actually, you know, as you say, going into the workplace, somebody might think, well, actually, you know, it's very difficult going in, getting the metro, kind of that's, you know, becomes quite feel overwhelmed by your day before you've even started. But then so many companies that actually want everybody to be back in the office, you know.
Are you still seeing that?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Uh-huh.
That's interesting.
Yeah, we are still seeing very much that. Well, I had a meeting yesterday with one of our clients, and they had a couple of people that worked remotely for other reasons, kind of childcare reasons and things. But the rest of it is they wanted everybody to be in the office. A lot of companies that we're talking about still don't have flexibility in the working hours. You know, so a company in a different part of the country, they are kind of like, okay, we need to be more flexible, but people still need to be at their desks from 9 to 5:30. And you're kind of thinking, but they all work from home, so actually. So yeah, I know it's kind of a bit off topic, but yeah, so we are very much still seeing that actually people need different things and want different things, and it's the company recognising, well, for what purpose are they wanting it for? Because not everybody has gone off and got a diagnosis done. I mean, I suppose some people can't necessarily articulate why they feel more comfortable in the home working environment as opposed to being in an office with 30, 40 people, isn't it? So there's still quite a...
And you're right, it's hard to articulate, mm-hmm. but you have that sense of discomfort, but yeah. hard to pinpoint what that is yeah. if you haven't yet explored neurodiversity mm-hmm. as an option.
Yeah, and I remember, there's two people I'm thinking of actually, where they've worked in like busy call centre type environments, and one of them had made a reference that she couldn't, you know, she struggled with that environment, felt very, very overwhelmed, kind of lost her focus completely. But if she put some headphones on and sat with her headphones on during the day, that helped her to be able to give the focus mm-hmm. and, you know, that helped the whole environment for her to work in. Do you think that's the type of thing that people have started to think about, isn't it?
Yeah, we're starting to see that, aren't we, that people are using headphones or requesting quiet pods in the workplace as well. You know, increasingly that's an option, and it's not as expensive as having somebody be unproductive because they're getting easily distracted in the workplace.
Yeah, in the workplace, yeah. So, you know, from the point of view that, so say somebody's been off and been tested mm-hmm. and they've come back and they are diagnosed with, well, actually I've got one at the minute. So she went off with anxiety, mm-hmm. believed that she was autistic, was then got a diagnosis of autism, and then is still now waiting for a diagnosis of ADHD. She wants to come back to work mm-hmm. and she's saying her anxiety's pretty much there with it, she's kind of, and she has been very well supported by the NHS actually, she's pretty much there, but now we're having to assess her about coming back into the workplace around the autism as opposed to the anxiety. She went off with anxiety, but obviously now the point is kind of actually we need to make sure that all the reasonable adjustments are made to facilitate a return back to work because of the autism and the potential ADHD. So it's kind of been a bit of a shift over, and it's been quite difficult for the employer to kind of think, right, okay, where are we at? You know, is the anxiety an issue? You know, she didn't have concerns before she went off around the autism. And, mm-hmm. You know, we were managing situations based upon how she felt. Then the employer needs to do more than what's reasonable to be able to ensure that she can come back into the workplace and and she feels safe within the workplace from a psychological point of view. What's your thoughts on that? I mean, obviously that's kind of a real life situation, and obviously the employer's just kind of thought, I don't know what to do, I don't know how to deal with it. It's quite daunting, isn't it?
It is daunting as an mm-hmm. employee, because you're right, you've got two conditions, well, potentially three conditions yeah. there mm-hmm. to yeah. understand mm-hmm. and to manage. I guess I would be led by the employee themselves, you yeah. know, have they identified mm-hmm. any reasonable adjustments
yeah.
that they need? And have they identified adjustments and are they reasonable?
Yeah, definitely. Because mm-hmm. you don't have to feel as though, you know, people can come, and actually in this situation, there's been like a wellness plan put together through the NHS. And so it's been a good process to go through, and it's been very structured, which has been very helpful for the employer. But I think one of the important points there that you've just said is what's reasonable, or what are the adjustments, and then what is reasonable, kind of what can the company, because you haven't got to say yes to everything.
Absolutely.
I think that's
yep.
the biggest point where people think they've got a list of demands, so to speak, you know, and actually they want all these things before they return to work, and actually that's not always what it's about. It's about trying to reach a middle ground to what works for both parties, isn't it?
It is, yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. If you're a paramedic and your idea of an adjustment is that you'd like to work from home, mm-hmm. then that's not reasonable.
Never
going to
work,
is
it?
In the context of that role, is uh-huh. it? So it has to work for the role and for the employer, doesn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, uh-huh. So I think probably the message there is kind of making sure that people don't feel overwhelmed when that conversation comes up, isn't it? You know, making sure that people feel actually they know where to reach out to be able to get the support to understand it a little bit further.
Sure, that support for line managers is really important, and the support for the individuals as well. But also recognising that, you know, any adjustments that you might make or accommodations, I suppose, in the workplace, for instance, if you're able to offer a quiet space, that's going to benefit your entire workforce, not just that one individual mm-hmm. who is coming to you saying that they have autism.
Yeah, and there are plenty of adjustments that can be. So I think one of the ones that we talked about with this lady was kind of actually she just sometimes needs a bit of space, so she just needs to take herself off for a quick walk, which she does during break time, so not during the working time, you know, but she has a break on the morning, one in the afternoon, and then at lunchtime, but she just takes herself out for 10 minutes, walks around the block, and then comes back, you know, and that's what she wants to be noted down as an adjustment for her. So that's ideal, isn't it? Exactly, yeah, and that doesn't make any difference to anybody within the company, you know, as long as she feels well and safe, you know, she can go off and do that and then come back in and kind of reapproach. And it's those things, isn't it, that kind of actually we can introduce to make sure that people feel comfortable that when they're in the workplace that they have that control themselves from that point. Yeah.
And there's a lot of accommodations that would be low cost or no cost. Just like that.
What, and without kind of putting you on the spot, what type of adjustments do you think there could be? I mean, we've talked about things like putting headphones on, potentially going out for a walk, having a bit of quiet space. Is there anything else that you could think of from that point of view? And again, you know, every situation and every case is different, but just as a, you know, hopefully make someone think, oh yeah, actually, yes, that could happen or that could happen.
I guess it depends on what the individual themselves is struggling with. You know, so if it's noise stimulation, then actually absolutely headphones or the quiet space or the quiet pod would work. If it's struggling with change and you've got a policy of hot desking, then think about whether or not you can book hot desk, book that, or have a permanent desk. Sometimes people who have autism might be sensitive to not just noise, but also to, say, sensory things. So thinking about uniform as well. Your fabrics and whether or not you've got a uniform policy does that have to be enforced? It's not that long ago that, you know, lots of law firms insisted women had to wear high heels for work, which I'm sure, you know,
might not get away with this easy now, but yes.
Get away with it, but it's not that long ago,
is it?
And it's creating conditions for people who identify as neurodiverse to thrive will also benefit absolutely everybody else too.
So I think there are some great examples, because I just think it can become overwhelming for the employer to kind of know what's right and what's wrong and where to reach out to be able to provide support from that as well. When you mentioned about training, is that's kind of part of the training that you do as well, isn't it? You kind of do some training around neurodiversity.
We do training with line managers, and some training around neurodiversity specifically.
And because you do train in other areas as well, didn't you? You mentioned sleep and you mentioned around kind of the mental health training and the neurodiversity.
Sleep, I'm a bit obsessed with sleep training.
Are you? Yeah. Why is that?
I just, you know, we spend so much of our life in bed. Actually, we might as well make the most of it.
Sleep well, and
it has a massive impact on our productivity. I think they say something like, on average, every employee loses 11 days of productivity per year,
right?
Because of poor sleep, and that's not the insomniac employees. That's every employee.
Right. Okay.
So we're way less productive when we haven't had enough sleep. It's another bandwagon.
Well, it's quite interesting, because I think I've kind of noticed that more over the last few months, actually, of what my sweet spot of sleep is. You know, and I kind of think if I get that, then actually I can function quite well during the day. You know, I like about 7 hours, 40 minutes, isn't it?
7 hours, 40 minutes, I like it.
7 hours, 40 minutes of, like, if I can get 7:55, I'm on the moon. But it's those things that actually then you functioning during the day is better, because you feel more aware. Well, for me, I kind of have a better awareness, kind of more awake and more, you know, able to do things, more engaged with everything. So I do. I've just realised this 7 hours 40.
Well, I hope you're not measuring it. It does seem a lot. It's good. I hope you're not measuring it on a watch, though, because
they're
so what we know about people who wear watches that tell you that they're monitoring your sleep, they're actually more anxious about their sleep, and that makes their sleep worse.
Oh, does it? I'm very aware of time during sleep. I have got like an Amazon Alexa, like the Show ones. I wake up and look at that during the night and then go back to sleep again. I need to know the time while I'm asleep. Yeah. But, it's kind of completely off topic. So that sleep training that you do, is that with employees as well as kind of not necessarily with managers, but kind of with employees?
It's just about helping us to sleep better and thinking about the top tips that we might have to enable us to get that consistent level of sleep.
Yeah, which very much falls into kind of our well-being side, doesn't it? You know, kind of making sure that people feel comfortable from a well-being point of view as well. Yeah, interesting. So you've obviously given us a good example of what a business can do to make themselves friendly with regard to neurodiversity. And obviously we've talked about kind of a couple of different types of conditions around maybe it's ADHD or autism. Can you give me examples of businesses that do well within the workplace focusing upon that area?
So there's a local water and energy solutions business, Wave. I don't know if you've Wave, and they seem to be paving the way in the Northeast as an inclusive employer. So they've got inclusive policies and procedures. They've trained their managers in awareness of neurodiversity. They're managing change really carefully and inclusively. So having an understanding that, you know, some of our neurodiverse colleagues might find change difficult, mm-hmm. and, you know, carefully addressing any change in the workplace, particularly with that group of people who they've identified or who have, you know, made it known that they experience autism. They've got a flexible working policy, they encourage home working, they've got software in to support ADHD and dyslexia. And actually, just another note on in terms of software, one of the things we've come up against in other organisations, not in WAVE, is that you know, we've got some great software out there available to support people who are experiencing ADHD and dyslexia particularly. And it's often free to access if you use the Access to Work government grant for that. Mm-hmm. But we're hitting a barrier with IT departments saying, oh, I'm sorry, you can't have that because it's not been approved. And that can be a real barrier. So it's not just about businesses need to support people to access the Access to Work funding, but then make sure that they can implement the suggestions
that come from it. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So WAVE have offered the software, they've offered coaching for people around workplace ADHD too, and then they have this wonderful living library of people in the team who have shared their experiences of ADHD, autism, dyslexia, in order to help other people in the organisation, which I just think is a wonderful experience. And it's, you know, particularly if you've got line managers and senior leaders able to do this, then it's helping to break down stigma and break down barriers.
Yeah, break down the barriers.
In the workplace.
There's so many useful things that you've said there, really, about policies, making sure that they're inclusive, but also around that. I think one of the crucial things is around the training of the managers, isn't it? Mm-hmm. To make sure that the managers are on board with what happens and how the process takes place. So I think that's really important. And the other bits around the change management as well, because I think some businesses, you know, kind of move through change so quickly, but they're not always kind of taking on board everybody that's around them. So there's some really good suggestions that are in there as well.
I think we see some organisations who are, they're able to allow flexibility, which mm-hmm. enables neurodiverse people to absolutely thrive. If mm-hmm. you can block out time in the working day, you get the best of your colleagues who engage in that hyper-focus.
And that's part of it, isn't it? It is the hyper-focus that they've potentially got there.
Which is a real asset to the workplace.
And do you think WAVE did that because of the size of the organisation or because they'd experienced, you know, a few people coming forward? Or do you think it was just they were being very proactive and kind of taking that next step forward?
I think it's good people in key positions who are able to be vulnerable themselves. Mm-hmm. And I think it's being backed by values that, again, the leadership team are living out.
That comes back to what was in at the beginning, really, isn't it? Having the culture and the values established enables this type of situation to be able to make a difference. And I think that Access to Work scheme, again, I think that's a real positive thing that any company can can use and access and, you know, find out what they can do to be able to help their employees.
Absolutely.
So I think that's a great piece of advice there as well. Do you think there's still kind of a misconception of neurodiversity? Do you think there's still kind of an opinion that people have? And maybe that's because of lack of understanding or not wanting to accept it. What do you think kind of, do you think there is a misconception around
there it? There are. I think there are still misconceptions. I think the big one is that neurodiversity is a deficit.
Right.
And it just isn't. It's a competitive advantage.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It really is. Who doesn't want a diverse workforce?
Yeah.
I don't want everybody thinking the same, behaving the same, responding the same.
Mm-hmm.
When we've got people who are able to see things from other perspectives, who are able to have that different level of cognitive flexibility and creativity, what an enormous advantage to your team.
Yeah. So it can actually add benefit to you. So I think really that point there is around people need to step out and understand more. And whether that's because someone's presented with a diagnosis or just as an awareness of actually, like what WAVE's done, kind of, you know, to make the workplace inclusive. So if somebody does present with it, then it's there and it's set up in place already, isn't it? And do you think embracing neurodiversity would positively impact around how the team works, the dynamics, the overall productivity? I know you've touched on kind of the productivity element of it. Do you think that you know, in general, it can really support the dynamics of a team.
I think it massively supports the dynamics of a team. Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. That when you've got people in your team who have very different strengths, mm-hmm. then being able to work together as a team with strong leadership, then absolutely, that's a key advantage.
A key advantage of it. Yeah. Okay, great. So, I mean, obviously, you've given us, you know, so many useful pieces of information there today. And I think for me, wanting to talk to you was about raising that awareness element of neurodiversity and how it impacts upon the workplace. And I suppose, in essence, people or companies not being scared when that comes up and thinking, what do we do? How we deal with it? And what's the right thing and wrong thing to do? Because people can fall into the right or wrong quite easily. So I think that's the kind of valuable points that's there. So from our conversation, is there any kind of key takeaways that you want to kind of, you know, reiterate? Or if there's anything that you kind of think actually as a company, this would be really beneficial to put in place, whether you have had a diagnosis or not? What is there any key piece of advice, really?
I think it's embracing neurodiversity at every level in the organisation. So from retention of colleagues, which is what we're discussing here in terms of making reasonable adjustments, yeah. mm-hmm. but also trying to think about how we recruit that neurodiverse workforce.
Yeah.
And that might be about designing your adverts slightly differently, mm-hmm. because we know that, you know, some people with autism particularly might be very literal about how they interpret your advert in terms mm-hmm. of the experience that you've said that is essential.
Yeah,
well, I've only got 3.5 years experience. I haven't got four,
Years,
I'm not
yeah.
going to apply. Mm-hmm. So thinking about how you welcome people right at the start, at the point where you're writing adverts, and in interviewing people and being creative around that, and mm-hmm. sharing perhaps your interview questions beforehand or the interview format,
yeah.
so that we're getting the best out of people from mm-hmm. the start, yeah. and seeing some of that creativity and those strengths coming through.
Yeah, fantastic. No, that's absolutely brilliant. So do you want to just tell listeners where we can find out a little bit more about you and about TalkWorks? Or where are you on? Are you on social media or is it websites? Where will we find you?
Yeah, we have a website. So that's talk-works.org.uk. Mm-hmm. But you can also just find us on LinkedIn,
right.
And Facebook too.
Yeah. Brilliant. And obviously you've got the team that work there as well, isn't it? So you've got
a wonderful team yeah. at TalkWorks, mm-hmm. yeah. So we've got a team of counsellors, psychotherapists, mm-hmm. psychologists and a business team too.
Yeah.
We're based over at the business centre in Gateshead.
But
well. we work remotely too, so mm-hmm. we have some of our therapists would be working over video mm-hmm. from home because that suits them best too.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that's, you know, enables us to offer our services to a wider area.
Yeah,
fantastic. Which is what we're passionate about.
Yeah. Thank you very much for that. That obviously wraps up this episode of Real World HR. And obviously a massive thank you to Jen for coming to share her insights and expertise with us today. I think it's just such an interesting topic. And obviously, as I say, you know, one that kind of is coming up time and time for us doing what we're doing and helping the employer to be able to kind of be the best place that it can be for the employees that's there. So if people want to head over to the show notes to connect with Jennifer and explore the steps that you can take to be a more inclusive employer, please do subscribe to the podcast so you don't miss out on future episodes, and please leave us a rating and a review. Real World HR, putting the human back into HR.